Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Did you know that Uprising is now a TV show as well as a radio show? We rely on subscribers to our YouTube channel to fund the TV production of Uprising, and you can sign up to be a subscriber at youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. When President Obama earned the moniker Deporter-in-Chief, it was a sad moment for a Democratic administration that had promised to back the DREAM Act and uphold a more progressive policy toward undocumented people. If you listen only to the rabid anti-immigrant right wing of the Republican Party, Obama has offered up amnesty to foreign nationals. But in reality, he has deported more undocumented immigrants than any other president in U.S. history. Even though his government says it only prioritizes those people with criminal backgrounds, in reality, criminals represent a small fraction of people being deported. As families are separated, the stories of heartbreak are occurring alongside a resurgence of militant actions by people who've had enough and are risking deportation by engaging in civil disobedience. The stories of undocumented people, particularly youth, are detailed in a new book by Eileen Truax called Dreamers, An Immigrant Generation's Fight for Their American Dream. Eileen Truax is originally from Mexico. She's a journalist and immigrant currently living in Los Angeles. She contributes regularly to Hoy Los Angeles and Unidos, and she writes for various Latin American publications, and she joins me in studio today. Welcome to Uprising, Eileen.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, you open your book with a story about the food closet in UCLA, which I thought was an interesting way to open it, or place to open it. It's a student-created venture for other students to help them have access to food in an emergency, which many students are doing after, especially the recession hit them hard. But particularly undocumented students are relying on this because they are not eligible for financial aid. Their status makes them ineligible. Tell us about this food closet and why it was a sort of become a symbol for the dire straits that these young undocumented people, the so-called dreamers, are in today.
Yes, I found this story and I thought that it was fascinating because it reflects very good what's going on right now with these young students that are trying to keep going, going to universities, going to college. They don't have a document, so they don't have the financial aid. They don't have the opportunity to do what you are supposed to do when you graduate from high school. And to find this space in a university like UCLA, one of the most renowned, the one that has the largest number of applications in the country, was very symbolic to me. What they're doing, there's this very small space. It was literally a closet that a group of students decided to use in order to put there some food, knowing that some of their fellow students didn't have the chance to eat sometimes during the day, since they don't have a financial resources. So I think that illustrates very well what happens in the life of undocumented students. For some of us, if we are just out there living our regular lives, it may not be an important or relevant story. What does an undocumented student to go to school? They get up, they go there, they study, and sometimes they graduate. But what's behind that?
Right.
The very effect that you have to decide what, at the moment you wake up in the morning and you have to make your first decision. I have to go to the school. Am I going to drive or I'm going to take the bus? If I'm driving, I'm going to get there on time, but I cannot drive because I don't have a driver's license. So I may go there, but they can stop me. They can
you risk,
give me
being pulled
a ticket
over.
Or even deported.
Yeah.
So, but the other way, then I have to take the bus, then another bus, another bus, then it's late. Every decision you make during the day has something to do with your immigration status. Mm-hmm. At the moment you get to the school and you have to pay a full scholarship,
full tuition, right?
Full tuition.
Yeah. Because since undocumented immigrants are not eligible for in-state tuition, even though they've been living in the state they might be going to school in, they still have to pay the full tuition that an out-of-state student would have to pay, tens of thousands of dollars.
Tens of
up
thousands
until recently.
Of dollars. Recently,
yes.
Some states like California give some aid to them. But yet, you don't have another extra resources that you may need. Sometimes you need to work. Sometimes at home situation is difficult. And the last thing you think about is what am I going to eat today? So when I found this space, I found some food that people puts there just for people who needs that, and that may be any kind of people going through hard times.
Yeah, it's not just for undocumented students.
Of course
yeah.
not. It's not labeled that yeah. way. But there's a visitor's book, and people who uses the place and uses the food leave messages. And when I start reading the messages, I found out. The messages were very moving, very touching, saying, I am a person with no documents, and I wouldn't be able to eat today if it was not for this place. I've been living in my car. I have to eat $1 burritos for Taco Bell. The stories are very moving, and you realize that these are students helping other students because they understand what's going on, but you don't talk about it.
Right. And so that's also pointing to the sense of abandonment that these young dreamers have faced, that they live their lives, they graduate, and then higher education becomes very difficult, but if they manage that, then they graduate, then what? Getting a job is almost impossible. And they're stuck in a legal limbo, at least up until the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals programs that not everybody is eligible for necessarily. And so people started taking matters into their own hands more and more and more. Undocumented youth started risking deportation. And you profile a lot of these young folks, very brave individuals who have become very organized. One of them is a very interesting person named Muhammad Abdullahi, or Mo. I've had him on our program before. He's organized with the National Immigrant Youth Alliance and Dream Activist, where we covered their very bold border actions. And Mo is not a Mexican American or even Latin American. He's Iranian, undocumented himself. And he has a very interesting drive, a militant streak that has actually turned off some people. And you had a couple of interviews with him. Tell us about Mo and the direction in which he has pushed undocumented activism.
I think Mohammed and the whole group of the NIA, this organization, may symbolize the most radical, if you want to call it some way, area of this movement. When I started trying to write something about dreamers, the first obstacle that I found is that there's no one kind of dreamer. You cannot define, oh, dreamers are this way, or dreamers are like this. Or there's a very vast array of organizations, of ways to work. You have at some point these groups that are very by the book, that they go to Congress, they put a suit, and they talk to Congress members, they do lobby, they are, let's say, in a way, very well behaved. And then you have a lot of organizations, and you can end up in those that are doing civil disobedience, and that's what the NIA are doing. They decided that, okay, they tried to pass the DREAM Act legislation, and let's remember that the DREAM Act was introduced in 2001. So the piece of legislation has been there for a lot of time, 14 years now, has not passed. And at some point then decided, the last time that there was a close chance to pass the legislation was in 2010. Mm-hmm. That time it passed in the House. It was 5 votes short in the Senate.
That was the closest it ever came. Yeah.
The closest it ever came. And at that moment, young people already had social media. They were very well connected to the country. They were very well organized. And they decided, okay, if we're not going to have this, we have two options. We can wait till 2012, next election, or maybe a few more years, or we can start doing something by ourselves. So they decided to take the matter into their hands, and they start doing these actions just to put the issue out there, to let people know their stories, their situation. And when you block a street and they're going to arrest you, and that arrest may mean that you're going to be deported, and you still do it, you're sending a very strong message.
Right.
I have nothing else to lose.
Right.
So please take a look at me.
Yeah.
Listen to me because no one else is doing it.
And these folks are doing this in the tradition of the United States.
Of
this
course.
Is a long U.S. Tradition that goes back to the civil rights movement, which took its cue from the anti-imperialist actions in India under Gandhi. They're very, very strong actions, and they have sort of, what effect have they had? Because you document one of the early actions in Alabama, a state with mm-hmm. some of the harshest anti-immigrant
yeah.
rules, and I loved how you profiled the meetings, that training meetings that these young folks went to. They were so prepared. They knew down to the second what their choreographed actions would be, how to talk. They did all this training for how to talk to the press, how to get arrested, how to interact with the police. They were extremely organized.
Yes. I love one of the quotes from Maud when he says, if we are lucky, by 5 p.m., we're going to be arrested.
So if we're lucky.
They were looking for that because they know that's the way to put the message out. Definitely. I think this is part of a long change of civil disobedience, of the civil rights fight in the U.S. And when you ask me if this has worked or if they got something out of this, you just mentioned DACA. And although it's not by far a good solution for this, because, you know, DACA is only, they only give, this action only gives them a work permit.
And a temporary.
It's temporary. Yeah. It doesn't give residency, not a path to citizenship. It only lasts for 2 years. Now it's renewed for other 2 years, but still makes this population vulnerable. It's not a recognition of their civil rights in a full way. But we have DACA, and I think that's a direct response to the movement that this one mm-hmm. and other organizations has done. I think in the recent years, the Dreamers have become the face, the most kind face of the whole pro-immigrant movement.
Hmm. And DACA is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program that President Obama unveiled. He recently had another program, Deferred Action for Parental Accountability, DAPA, which has now been held up legally. Let's talk about another figure that you profile in your book, Dreamers, and that's a person who no longer lives in the United States, which is really interesting because most of everybody else that you profiled were Dreamers in the U.S. But then you followed the story of a young woman who was deported. And we hear
yes.
about these statistics of people who've been deported, and unless you personally know somebody who's been deported, it's really hard to personalize it, to humanize it. Tell us about Nancy Landa, who she is and where you met her first.
I think Nancy
And actually, Landa, you know, can you read for our listeners and our viewers a section from your book about her?
Sure. You want yeah. me to start with the reading?
Sure. We can set the stage for the story of Nancy Landa.
Okay. The chapter 4 is named Back to a Strange World. And on a Tuesday morning, just like any other, Nancy Landa got herself ready for work. Full-figured, with dark hair, olive skin, and a bright smile, she put on black pants, a blouse, and low-heeled pumps for her job at the government office in California. It was 2009, and at 29, Nancy was the very picture of success. She had graduated 5 years before with a degree in business administration from California State University, Northridge, and since then, she had doggedly climbed up the professional ladder, first in community service organizations and then in the public sector. Nancy made sure she had everything she needed for the day in her handbag, her wallet with $40 on it, credit and debit cards just in case, and her ever-present cell phone. She left the apartment she shared with her brother in Long Beach in Los Angeles County with plenty of time to get to the office. She got in her car, which she had bought just a few months earlier and was still paying off, and headed to the freeway. While she was driving down 3rd Street, a white van ordered her to pull over. It wasn't a Long Beach police or highway patrol vehicle, but Nancy wasn't worried. She pulled over to the side of the street, rolled her window down, and waited for the officer to perhaps cite her for some minor infraction or alert her to something about her car that needed attention. Then her nightmare began. Three people step up to Nancy's cars and inform her she was being detained. One of them, a woman, announced they were immigration agents. "Do you know why we are detaining you, right? Were you hiding from us?" said another. And they took her bat and escorted her into their vehicle, a van with no identifying markings. Her car stayed right where it was, parked on the side of the road. 2 hours later, Nancy found herself in a detention center in downtown Los Angeles, and just 8 hours later, she was deported to Tijuana, Mexico, with only the clothes on her back. She had no friends or family there, no past. All she had was the handbag they had returned to her once she was on the other side of the border, with the $40, credit cards, and cell phone. And just like that, on an ordinary Tuesday that had begun like any other, the life Nancy Landa built for herself over the past 20 years was gone.
Eileen Truax reading from her book Dreamers, An Immigrant Generation's Fight for Their American Dream. So Nancy Landa, 20 years living in the United States. She's working. She's a young person. She has her car. And within hours, she's picked up and tossed into Tijuana, where she barely has any familiarity with this situation, with the place she's in. And she represents an interesting case because people often say, you know, if you want legalization, go to the back of the line and get in line and legalize. But Nancy Landa's family did just that. They tried to get her papers, right?
They did that. They came when Nancy was 9. She barely remembers her life in Mexico. And when they were here, they went to a notary. These people that sometimes tries or offers immigrants to help them with their documents, but they're no lawyers. So what they offered to the family was to apply for asylum. And, you know, when you apply for asylum and you present your case, they take a while to decide. And meanwhile, you have your documents to stay legally in the country because we have a huge backlog in the immigration courts. This may take 4, 5, 6 years until they solve your case about asylum. But once they solve, if the response is no, you have to go back to your country.
Right, they said, then you're in the system, and then they track you down and say you have
to leave. They track you down. So, but the thing is this. Years came by, and the notary was out of sight of the family, so they didn't even know that the case was denied. They didn't even know that they had a deportation order. And, of course, any of this information was not in the mind of Nancy because their parents wanted to do something good for the children, but they didn't share all the information. Mm-hmm. They were just happy that they had documents so they could go to school, they could buy a car, they could do their lives. And this is very interesting. Let's think that many of these dreamers came to the country at the age of 3, 4, 5, 6 years, 9 years. You are not really aware about your situation. You just
American kid, yeah.
You think as an American kid, you think you are actually an American kid. You just don't have the documents that say that. So to be back in a country that is not really your country, where you have nothing. And
she actually had the added advantage that others don't in the fact that she had technical skills. She had some savings in her bank account in the U.S. She had a cell phone that worked. And she had family and friends who immediately drove to Tijuana, helped her find a place to stay the night. Her family also deported. But how do others who don't have the privilege of those skills and those bank savings survive?
It is terrible.
I mean, is there sort of a mini population now in areas like Tijuana of people who speak, you know, American English because they spent so many years here and were deported but don't really fit in any place, a sort of no man's land?
There's a very interesting project right now in Mexico. The name is Los Otros Dreamers, in Spanish, The Other Dreamers. Mm-hmm. This is led by Jill Anderson. She is an academic from Texas. She went to Mexico for a postdoc program. And then she found out that there was this population of young American people working in call centers in Mexico City. She started tracking them, and her estimate is that maybe about 500,000 deported or returned dreamers in Mexico.
Half a million.
That's the estimate about Jill in the last 10 years. Let's think about this. President Obama, during 6 years, has deported 400,000 people to several countries, but most of them are from Mexico and other countries of Latin America, but mainly Mexico. So a 500,000 in 10 years kind of
not
makes sense.
Right?
Many of them are in their 20s.
So they're working in a call center for what, American companies?
Yeah, of course. Of
speaking
course.
English.
Speaking English.
Earning probably half the wage they would do in call centers in the United States. So the U.S. is happy. U.S. companies are happy to hire them on the other side of the border.
It's very likely that some of us have talked to them whenever we call to our cable service, our phone service, just to complain for someone. They're talking to us. That's the only way they can get a job in Mexico because, as you can imagine, if you go there, you have no background. You don't speak the language. You know no one.
Your academic credentials don't necessarily transfer.
They don't help you, so that's the only option that you have. But most important of all, even if you get a job, even if you start a life, you do not belong there. Your family's here. Your friends are here. Sometimes your property is here. Nancy left a car in the middle of the street, and she doesn't have an idea what happened to it. So you have a life here. The American society knows that you have a life because you have been part of it. The country knows that you have a life here. And suddenly, everything's gone.
Now, in addition to the stories of people like Nancy Landa, Mohammed Abdullahi, you do share with us the stories of some of the politicians, the very tiny handful of stalwart politicians who have done their best to try to push for the DREAM Act. One such person is Senator Dick Durbin, who has raised awareness in Congress year after year about immigrant youth, undocumented youth. What motivates him? What are some of the things he does in Congress?
But for me, it was very touching to find out what he was doing. Every certain time, what Senator Durbin does is he prints out in a very large scale the picture of one of the dreamers. So he goes up in the Congress to talk to his fellow colleagues there. And he starts telling the story of the person whose picture he has in there. He has been telling the stories of dreamers for a very long time, just trying to convince other senators that these are people, these are stories. When we talk, and that's a huge problem here, we have politicized the issue of immigration. We speak about 11.5 million people, 2 million dreamers. We are all about numbers, and we forget about stories. Yeah. I think what Senator Durbin has done is to put a face and a name on every one of these youth. And he is telling, you know, just take a look around because they're sit next to your children in their schools. Yeah. They're your neighbors. They're here.
And you also tell us a story of current LA City Councilman Gil Cedillo, the role that he's played in doing things like helping to pass the driver's licenses bill for immigrants, undocumented immigrants, which did pass in California. In the last couple of minutes we have left, you've got a whole chapter in your book called Undocu Queers, which is something we rarely hear about. Tell us about this group of undocumented youth who are also a part of the LGBT community and might face sort of a double the oppression.
Yes. When I was doing all the research, I found out that some of these youth were actually organized, creating a subgroup inside the movement, and they started calling it Undocu Queers. They youth that had been living, one of them told me, in a double closet. They have to hide their sexual orientation, and they have to hide their immigration status, and to live in that way in a double shadow during the most vulnerable years of your life, it can be a burden. But to be part of the movement has given them some strength, some identity, and the courage to say, okay, if at some point I'm gonna go out of the gay closet and say, I am gay, I have the strength to do it also with my immigration status and the other way around. Some of them started with the pro-immigrant movement and they realized that they were strong and they had a network to support them to fully be what they wanted to be.
Well, I want to thank you, Eileen, so much for joining us. Much more to talk about, but I'm sure our audience can pick up a copy of your book and check it out and learn all of the stories that you write about. Thanks so much and best of luck to you.
I hope. Thank you so much.
My guest, Eileen Truax, is the author of the book Dreamers, an Immigrant Generation's Fight for Their American Dream.